Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio Program. I'm Susan Larison-Dance, and today I know that you are really going to enjoy what I think is going to be quite a deep continuation of a subject we kind of began in the last show. When we had Joel Garbin and Jean Manning here talking about new energy, it's one aspect of what we're going to talk about today with Barbara Shacker. Now, Barbara Shacker has been very much involved in her husband Michael Shacker's book project, Global Awakening, New Science and the 21st Century Awakening. Michael experienced a massive brain injury in the spring of 2008. In fact, the book really talks about this in a very poignant introduction as to really a miraculous journey that Michael has been through and what a brilliant, brilliant person he is. And what this work calls us to do is it invites us to understand our own history. And I feel that often in the modern day, so many of us are so busy and we've lost touch with some of our education, perhaps, depending on the depth of our education. In some parts of the world, including the U.S., our education may not run as deep as we would like, and we may not even understand our true history. And so I really feel that this topic is going to bring us full circle. It's going to invite us to better understand our true history, as well as how it applies to the world right now. Now, on the website right now, on the show page, I have globalawakening.net as one of the sites that you can go to. But I am called to add to that globalregen.net, which I will add after the show, but I wanted to point that out, which is the Global Regeneration Network, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. Today, we do have an open chat room if you're listening live. You are welcome to go into the chat to enter your comments and questions, and assuming you have a Blog Talk Radio login, let me just advise you of that. If you're new to the show, you have to have a login to participate in the chat, but you are most welcome there in that community. So without further delay, I'm really happy to be bringing Barbara Shacker on the Frontier Beyond Fear. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. This is a great day.
It really is. It's actually a beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest, filled of the kind of hope that your book has. Because, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, we have this long rainy season. And around this time of year, it shifts very dramatically. It shifts. Anyone who's lived up here knows it's just it's very sudden. And suddenly, the sun is out. And so I think it's very symbolic of the awakening. Now, as we get into this, Barbara, first of all, I wonder if you could tell us about Michael, how he came to write this book. I know it took him many, many years, and his journey, just a glimpse into that, and how you became involved in this work as well.
Okay. Well, Michael was a, had a genius IQ and this amazing memory and a deep interest in people and in the world and a deep love of the whole world. And so as a young man, he turned down a Regents scholarship to college, and he went to Alaska. And while he was in Alaska, he almost died. He was on a fishing boat, and the captain was drunk, and a storm came up, and he had to figure out how to get the radio working, which wasn't functioning, to call the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard was able to come, and they lifted him and everyone out by helicopter. But as he was looking down and watching the boat crash on the rocks, he had this this whole kind of awakening within him, and he knew that he wanted to do something to awaken the world and to really save the planet, because he really felt that it was already in a downward spiral, when actually there was so many good things that had never been told or had been covered up and people didn't know about. So he went on a journey, traveled around, talked to people, and in the meantime he studied in the libraries. And what he discovered was this holistic view of history and a global need for understanding everything. So he started actually to write the first global history of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met him in 1975 in North San Juan, California, it was the Back to the Land movement, and I was 25 and he was 23, and he hadn't started to write yet, but he had done an enormous amount of research already.
Yes.
So soon after that, he started to write this kind of a synchronistic history. He found a lot of parallels in the development of all the different people around the world. And so the truth was so fascinating. And he is kind of a storyteller. So his way of telling things is different. So it's not like this academic tome.
Right.
His writing is very direct and very accessible, and so it's really written for just about everybody. And, you know, he was looking for answers for himself as a young man, and the three basic questions that he had was, where are we? How did we get here? And where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
So these three basic questions are really at the core of what everyone what the whole question about what is the purpose of our life, you know, and what is the meaning of history. So what this book does is it grounds people in the meaning of history, but it does it in a syntropic way. In other words, a way that is very elegant and brings forth the most interesting and the most crucial, the most important information. And a lot of this information, most of it, is not taught in colleges or schools.
Yeah.
And so this is really a new story.
Yes. And
of everything.
I have to say, it's kind of synchronistic if this would come up now, because I think the more you get into wanting to expand your own consciousness, the more you begin to wonder, you know, what if the voices of the past had to have to say about this? And it's actually a question I had asked, and yet it's overwhelming, isn't it? I mean, how do you begin to discover it? I mean, you've got the internet, maybe, that helps us, but it's just such an overwhelming task to find a way to, you know, a path of discovery through our own past. And I will say, you are right, this book, I use the word approachable very much, and it also it really opens doors, because you start reading about different figures, and a lot of us, you know, we're familiar with some of these people, of course, different philosophers and different times in history, but we may not remember a lot about it, or the nuances that we never knew, like you said, it just wasn't taught. And it really opens the door to being curious about these things, where I think a lot of people are going to take this book and really enjoy it, and it's such a great survey, and then also go deeper. There will be certain voices, it's already happened to me, with this book that, oh, you know, I really need to look at this voice more. Mm-hmm. I need to go deeper with this person. I think that's exactly what Michael would want for mm-hmm. us to do. So it's very inspirational in that way. Now, entering into this book, because it is, first of all, before we go into this, just your own involvement with the project, Barbara, because I know that Michael did eventually have this traumatic injury and this miraculous, he's recovering really quite miraculously. And I know, maybe you can speak just a little bit to that before we enter into the book itself and how we want to go through it.
Yes. Okay. Well, Michael's not here talking to you today.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. of his brain injury, he lost almost all of his left hemisphere. And so the brain loss that he had in this brain injury was about 20 times larger than the amount of brain damage that would wipe out speech. So he's really got his right hemisphere, mm-hmm. and that he's talking with his right hemisphere now. Luckily, it didn't get to his cortex. His entire cortex was spared on both sides. So this has been, a real blessing. And fortunately, he's not depressed or any of those other things. Well, I had spent my whole adult life working with people with strokes and brain injuries. And I developed and discovered a method that uses the alternate hand, or the hand that's connected to the undamaged side of the brain, to access the other speech center and reactivate mm-hmm. it. And I learned that we talk with both sides of the brain as young children, and then the brain specializes. But those pathways are still over there. And so it's kind of like a spare tire in your trunk, just waiting for us to take it out. So the access to that is through the sensory trigger, is what I call it. It is the sense of touch, and that's the most, that's the deepest, most primal sense. It is also the sense that's most interconnected neurologically to the entire brain. So I first worked with my father, who was untreatable global aphasic, and mm-hmm. for 9 years he only had 9 words to say, and then I suddenly had sort of an epiphany or a vision of this, of how I could help him talk again. And I did get him talking again. And I had, being an artist, I made the first picture language for aphasia, which is a loss of speech. And I got him using these pictures, and I got him using his left hand to trace and to draw and to copy the words. And I did it in a certain sequence. I discovered an ideal sequence of sensory cues, and used that. And my father basically did this on his own after I taught him how to do this. And in 18 months, he said his first spontaneous word. And then after that, the words started coming back one by one. And so by the time he passed away, 22 years after his stroke, he had gained enough language that he could go to the bank or the mailbox or to the grocery store and go on the bus by himself, go downtown. And, so he was functional. And then he also became an artist with his left hand, which is really interesting. So that recovery, I turned that recovery and into a I was a librarian, and I left my library to create a computer program. So I designed the first talking computer program for aphasia recovery in the late 80s and 90s. And so I created strokefamily.org when we moved to Woodstock, and that was in 95. And I have continued to help people who are untreatable. Well, then Michael has this massive stroke, Only this time, it's worse damage even than my father's damage. Because,
and you would have known at the time, too. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, I've just got to stop for a second and say, mm-hmm. what a remarkable synchronicity that you would be in Michael's life. I mean, what a perfect person to be there to
mm-hmm.
deal with this. And you must
yeah.
have known the danger right then and there, too. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, that's really,
you know,
amazing.
I think it's
itself.
A spiritual connection. I
it
think,
is.
You know, it's a spiritual connection. We chose each other,
mm-hmm.
and unknowingly we chose each other for good or ill, and for our whole lives. And so it is really fascinating. And it's so interesting. Our lives were parallel too when we hadn't met, because I also turned down college degrees because I felt that I needed to be working outside of the regular, outside of the box, you know, and outside
uh-huh.
of the regular path. And so we were definitely kindred spirits when we met. And so what happened after his brain injury, I started working with the sensory trigger immediately. I was working in the critical ward at Albany Med Center. And if we have time, I'd like to tell what happened, because I started working with him holding his left hand. This is when he was still in a coma. And when he came out of a coma, you know, the nurse would come in and she would look at Michael and she would ask him a question to see if what kind of awareness he had that's back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came in one day and she asked him, Mr. Shacker, did you see your mother this morning? And he looked at her blankly, and then she kind of just went on with her work. And I said, well, just a minute. I want to show you something. Come over here to the other side of the bed. And I said, okay, I'm gonna hold his left hand,
yeah.
and we're going to lean in and get eye contact with him, and I want you to ask him the same question. So she did, and he looked at her, and he nodded his head. And she gasped, and she said, oh, my gosh. That really does work. And she says, I'm going to always do this. This is amazing.
That's something.
So by even in that very critical condition,
yes.
It made a difference. It was connecting to the part of the brain that could understand and communicate. And I have to say I was really impressed with Albany Med Center, because they let the whole staff come over there and get a demonstration of this.
So they were learning. Well, that's what you
yeah,
want to
they were
see,
really
you know,
learning.
Actively
it was so
learning.
I was very encouraged from the beginning, you know, that okay, I can do this. We can do this.
You know, in your book or in Michael's book and the book you worked on together, really, because I know you
mm-hmm.
you had a real role in it in recent times.
Mm-hmm.
There is something about medicine and how we're awakening in medicine, and isn't it true that just in the littlest of ways, like that? Where it,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's just being open to something new. I mean, isn't that what awakening really is at its simplest
it is.
Level? It's simply being
uh-huh.
open. It doesn't have to be complicated all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that interesting as a demonstration, just in a simple way, is that we need to be more open and not necessarily assume you know everything, because that's where you get stuck in the box. And I
that's
think
right.
that's really, really nice that we're working with people like that. And, you know, as far as talking about this for a while, my view is that if we're talking about this, there's someone out there who needs to hear it. And
uh-huh.
even if we're not yet talking about the book, it doesn't matter, because we are in a way anyway. And there's someone
yeah.
out there I trust that needs to hear this. And,
I'm sure.
You know, maybe you can say something to anyone, since, you know, these strokes are becoming more prevalent, and especially, I mean, there are definitely people out there dealing with this, is I think you give them hope. I mean, when they're in that situation and they're sitting with someone that they love so dearly and they see them in this situation, you know, what reassurance can you give them, Barbara, to give them hope and to help them?
Well, I would encourage them to look into my work and
mm-hmm.
go to strokefamily.org and take a look at what's there, because over the last almost 40 years, I have learned so much and I have put together so much. And there's so many people that I've helped. And, you know, even if someone doesn't recover all of their speech, it's actually not necessary. This is a whole different kind of view where it provides a way to communicate meaningfully with them and to understand what kind of process they're going to go through and how you can help them on a very basic level, just on a very, you know, day-to-day level kind of thing. So I would tell them that there is absolutely hope, and that it all it requires is a lot of love and patience and a willingness to go through and to act, to take a part in the recovery, you know, and not be afraid, not to kind of set your own feelings aside and your own fears aside. You know, that fear that, which is tremendous, that, you know, they're never going to get better. So set that aside and just go ahead and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a certain sadness, too. Like, where is this person that I love? And you have to just think they're there, right? I mean, they're there.
Yeah.
You're right there.
They're there.
And even if you can't quite reach them, it's like being long distance or something. But they're still there, and I'm sure that would be hard, too. I mean, if you really,
that's very
you really
hard.
Love someone, you want to reach them.
It's extremely hard. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess, so it sounds like he's really doing quite well. I mean, just reading the foreword to the book, it was a really interesting story, what his friend had to say about him. And, you know, maybe the day will come when he can do interviews
well,
again.
That's what
and it
we're
sounds
working
like he's recovering
on.
His writing. And that's wonderful.
Yeah, we are working on that. And he's using his own manuscripts to use the text-to-voice reader. And then he follows that and echoes that back. And that has been a tremendous tool for him. But, you know, this is 5 years down the road. And, you know, I think we are going to get there, and in some fashion we will eventually get there. And you know, and so when we were taking Michael over to have a lens neurofeedback therapy by Dr. Larson, who wrote the introduction, on the way over he was talking about the book, and I at first I said, "Oh, you mean The Spring Without Bees," which is his first book, and he said, "No," and I said, "Oh, are you talking about your manuscript that, you know, your what do we call it at the time? It had a different 21st Century Transformation is what I think the title that we had." And so I says, is that what you're talking about? And he said, yes. I said, and he said, Stephen. And so I said, okay, so you want to talk to Stephen about this and maybe get this published, right? And he said, yes. And so we went there. We had a discussion with Stephen. Stephen immediately says, especially when he read the manuscript, he said, "I would feel terrible if this book was never published, and I'll do anything I can to help it get published." So he sent us to his publisher. And it, so then the following 2 years, we kind of worked together. But I did most of the work on the manuscript, and I... You know, since it was finished in 2007, basically, there was a lot that had to be updated. And so much had happened, you know, in the, you know, by the time you get to 2011 and 2012, a tremendous amount had happened. And so anything in the book that pertains to that is things that I added and you know, I know him so well, and we had such deep conversations over the years that I really knew what he would want, you know, in this book.
Yeah.
And also, our writing styles are pretty close. And so I really paid attention and blended it into his style so that it wasn't very obvious at all. And probably is not obvious to most people at all.
I certainly couldn't tell that there was any different style. And given that you are a librarian, that would really position you well. And I know that.
Oh my gosh, it helped me so much.
I have two librarians in my family, reference librarians, and they're helping me with my work. I mean, it's wonderful to be connected to a librarian. So I think you would have been just perfect for the project, especially given, you know, the many resources that it's referencing. So it seems like it was just kind of magical that you were here to help him in multiple ways.
Yeah, and it made me feel so good that I had these skills and that I was learning so much. I learned so much by having to do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me feel so good that I had these skills and the experience that I could actually do it. So it's all been just an amazing journey.
Yeah, it's almost representative of, well, it is, what's in the book. You know, just what's possible. And the way, you know, we have to approach this. I mean, maybe we can take this microcosm here and apply it to the macrocosm in that, you know, what I see in this story is you never lost hope. And, you know, that's where we need to be with the world, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the point that we may come to this place, which must have been really scary with this story, where we think we are at a dead stop almost, and the world is getting there in so many ways. Like, how are we going to get through this? And and then what happens? I mean, there's this shift, and that so many of us are hopeful is not only maybe happening even as we speak, which I believe it is, but the full force of it is about to come through. And, you know, maybe you can talk. I know there's a part in the book where we talk about, you know, how do we know from history, it had set. Oh, I so want to research the Enlightenment more now. Of course, I know about what many of us know about the Enlightenment. We know about these things to a point, but now we want to go deeper, getting into this book. How do we know that we are right on the verge of a paradigm shift? What are the characteristics? And give us an example of how that was dealt with in the past. You know, what are the parallels in terms of the thinking, the clashes of thinking, and the signs?
Okay. Well, paradigms shift because there's things start happening that don't fit our current worldview. So, what the kinds of things that start to, that we notice in a paradigm shift is that there's this emergence of anomalies, things that don't that go counter to the prevailing worldview. That contradict the old worldview. Right now we're emerging out of the mechanistic worldview, so nature violates the expectations of normal science, and answers must be found outside the paradigm. That's what happens. The emergence of I'm going to read just a little part here out of the book.
Yeah, feel free.
The emergence of a new analogy or paradigm and system of thought, revolutionary period upsets stability of normal science period. There's crisis and reconsideration of old paradigm by new thinkers and others to explain the anomalies. Then there's a bitter struggle that ensues. There's a paradigm resistance. From old scientists, paradigm wars are fought by the new worldview with facts and by the old worldview with ideology and bluster. After the old scientists die and the new paradigm wins, the struggle, a new normal science period, begins with the new underlying analogy or model, which is a, I'm going to explain a little bit here, it's a new scientific method. That changes the sets of rules.
Yeah.
So that is the process, that's the characteristics of a paradigm shift.
Yes.
And you can see that happening today.
Yes. I think that, you know, there have been a few researchers on this program recently, and every one of them is not willing to stay within the box of science. And I think it's really frustrating, the scientific method and that hostility that's in there right now to new ideas, the way they're just, you know, they're not funded or, you know, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. People are finding ways to get outside of it, you know, even if they don't have traditional funding. And I think that's part of the awakening. And then I know that you talk about it much later about the new physics, for example. I mean, a lot of people are becoming exposed to that just in the mainstream through What the Bleep Do We Know, that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that really, that was so inspiring to see, you know, it's such a demonstration of here, look, here are these incredibly intelligent people who have a spiritual side, and they're able to integrate both. Within their research. And I imagine if you're a quantum physicist and you don't have a spiritual side, it's really pushing you really hard because the things that you're seeing must just be just mystifying. I've heard stories of that, like, you know, they just don't want to believe some of the things that they're seeing because it doesn't fit, right? It just doesn't
right.
fit the view. And even Einstein was resistant to it when, you know, at first. I mean, he didn't live to see it come to its full fruition, but I know he had a resistance. And
yes.
So why don't we
Einstein
talk a little
was,
bit
was
about
a,
that?
Was a holistic thinker. He was a different
uh-huh.
kind of thinker.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's a really good example. We talk a little bit about Einstein in the book. I think what people need to realize is that we're caught in a grip of a mechanistic science. And mechanistic science was it came about in a paradigm shift from the medieval worldview. So
yes.
it was really a critical step. It's not that what mechanistic science has given us is bad necessarily, because we wouldn't be able to operate, we wouldn't be able to have you know, heart bypasses and all of the very important technology that we do have, and so many other things. But it's based on Newton's clockwork universe. That paradigm believes that everything works much like a machine, and that it reduces everything down to parts without seeing the dynamic of the whole, or trying to look beyond that of what we know. So the problem with the mechanistic paradigm, it is now really causing all of the world crises in all areas. It's really causing, it's the root problem of all of our.
Yes.
And it's basically the corruption of science. It's
yes.
not necessarily that science is bad. And I think we have to be careful not
mm-hmm.
to just throw science out the window.
Right.
There are some people who are doing that, but we do so at great risk.
Yes.
And what we have to understand is that the science is been corrupted. And so, you know, it was mechanism lends itself to this corruption because it's the belief that that we can control everything absolutely, and that we
yeah.
can absolutely predict what our machines and what our technology are going to do, and that
right.
there's a certain, we believe that they're infallible. And the best example of that is nuclear power.
Yes.
You know, and
we've seen what can happen there when it fails.
That's right. And
yeah.
so that's a good example. The you know, Chernobyl and Fukushima. Okay, those are big anomalies. Those are
mm-hmm.
big wake up calls.
Yes.
That we're not doing something right here. We're not doing something that's really in tune with the natural universe.
Yes.
You know, with the natural processes and ways of the world, and what is really important about the world and our life here on Earth. So there's a quote here that I think is really good. Clocks and mechanisms are good analogies for inanimate objects, but machine models are too limited to explain human beings, the mind, evolution, ecology, and most branches of biology. Since machines cannot reproduce, think, or evolve on their own accord, a broader model naturally emerged. And that new model is the organic paradigm.
Yes. So when we talk about the organic paradigm, how does it impact so many different areas of thought? I mean, it seems like, you know, what exactly does it mean, Barbara, for just different different areas? Because I know in the book we go into that. What does it carry for us?
Well, that's a huge topic.
It's a huge question. Maybe we need to step through it, little at a time, because that's such an important message.
Yeah, there's a wonderful chart, which is in the book, a comparison between the mechanistic and organic worldviews.
Yeah.
And so on the one side you have mechanistic worldview, which has limited models that underlie the traditional science and medicine and cannot explain living systems adequately.
Yes.
On the other side, with the organic, it's an encompassing organic biological model that underlies new paradigm sciences from physics to agriculture, medicine, technology, economics, and psychology. But I would goes on to say how our culture is also then becomes more flexible instead of so fragmented. In the mechanistic worldview, it's an anthropocentric universe, the planet Earth treated as a non-living thing to be exploited.
Yes.
And in the organic worldview, it is a complexity-centered universe, and planet Earth is shown to be a living system and one that can die.
Right.
And so in the mechanistic worldview, time and space is quantified. And in the organic, life, evolution, consciousness is quantified and given meaning. In the mechanistics, it studies objects and things as separate parts. And in the organic, it studies the relationships between the objects and the things.
I think the flow, it's more fluid. It flows more, is that right? I mean, as opposed to discrete little things. There is no there's a flow between everything.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm only reading part of this, but...
No, that's all right.
The old paradigm culture is based on oil, ultranationalism, and militarism, a huge military budget, small foreign aid.
Mm-hmm.
Top 1% owns 45% of all wealth. In the organic view, the counterculture based on transition from oil, world peace, and sustainable development increased foreign aid to at least $50 billion to stop terrorism, new economics to eliminate poverty. And when we look at law on the mechanistic side, it's laws and values designed to protect the rights of men, especially corporations, and men with property. I think he intentionally put the word men in there.
Interesting.
Organic worldview is laws and values designed to protect the rights of all, from women to blacks, gays, and all minorities, especially the poor and the middle class. A belief that war has always been a part of human nature. And in the organic view, know that war was invented and that it can be transcended in a future world peace.
Yes. That word transcend, that's so important, isn't it? That it's just totally getting out of this. Well, there's the paradigm shift right there, because you're just not stuck anymore in the same place. I mean, you're totally out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe now is a good time to also introduce this term global regeneration that I know comes up. But how we begin to get there.
Right. The easiest way to get there, I mean, the place to start is to start in your own house, in your own family, in your own community.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us have started to do this in any way that we can. Go through your house and take a look at the chemicals you have, your cleaning chemicals,
right,
and what is in the bathroom, and look at the kind of food that you're eating, and where does it come from, and what are the chemicals in the food, and is it organic food, or is it locally grown food? And you look at your clothes and you think, did I buy this at Walmart, or did I buy this locally?
Yes.
Or did I, this this shirt or something has a tear in it. This is kind of an old-fashioned idea. Well, I'm going to take the time to fix it. You know, it'll only take 10 minutes to sew this rather than to go out and buy a new shirt. So you can go through your whole life. If you can afford it, you go out and buy a hybrid car, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are starting to get off the grid. I know my daughter Jennifer and her husband in California are totally off the grid now. And, you know, and here in the East Coast, you know, we haven't been able to do that because we haven't had the financial resources to do it.
Right.
But now, because of deregulation, and this is only in some states, but it's growing all over the country, deregulation means that you can buy your energy from, you don't have to buy it from the monopoly, you can buy it from an alternative source and then go through the utility company. So, for instance, what we have here is Veridian, and New York State is unusual because it mandates 19% come from clean energy sources in all utilities in New York State. But if you go to a non-regulated, I guess, vendor or a supplier of your energy, which goes through your normal, you know, Central Hudson utility, you can almost double that amount and have, so now I've got 49% clean energy that I'm using because I'm buying it through this other vendor, this other utility company that's allowed to go through the normal, you know, the normal electric lines, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
So there's things that are emerging. There's solutions out there, and there's more and more solutions all the time. It's just there's been this huge blooming of alternative solutions and energy. It's just extraordinary, and it's an exciting time to live. But at the same time, we've got to get behind it, all of us. And I think one thing that people feel very discouraged, and but once you start
what can you do?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. They generally feel very discouraged. But when you start to look at all of these things that are out there and actually that you can do, then your whole life changes. It gets better. It's much more hopeful.
Right, and I know that out there with the current economy, you know, some people feel like, you know, what can I do right now? Like maybe they'd like to buy a hybrid car, and yet
right
now they can't. And, you know, maybe there are little ways, and I know part of the hope of this whole paradigm shift is to raise us all up, you know, so
mm-hmm.
that we're
mm-hmm.
not caught. Because there are a lot of people, just I see it all the time in my area. In fact, many of us are experiencing. You know, there's a reverse, by the way, to not pursuing a certain degree because you want to be outside the box. A very common
uh-huh.
thing that's happening within the spiritual community, it certainly happened to me, is not wanting to work in the field that you were trained because you have other things to do.
Yeah.
And when people do that, you know, that's a big step. You know, I'm a computer
mm-hmm.
scientist, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I have a master's degree. I'm not working in that field anymore. I'm doing this and other things
mm-hmm.
like this. And
mm-hmm.
it's because, and it's the reverse. It's like we're waking up in reverse. we're making those decisions now, but it does
mm-hmm.
have an effect because then you have to figure out how to make your way in the world. Okay, you've just stepped outside that box
mm-hmm.
of, you know, security and all that, and so now
right.
you have to create something new. And so I know there are a lot of people who listen to this show because I talk to a lot of people like this that are like this. And you know, you're making things happen and things, but it's an interesting time of growth. And I think it's important that no matter where we are in the spectrum, if we're building abundance or whatever, there are little ways that we can begin to step into changing things in our own world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel the kids are really starting to learn new things, too. You know, I'm a parent, and
uh-huh.
I hear things, such hopeful things. I mean, this generation that's in high school
mm-hmm.
right now that I'm watching, and I watched it grow up. I have a high schooler. It's so hopeful. It's just so amazing. In fact, I even saw this thing that kids nowadays, like if someone is having some kind of challenge, they're more likely to help them than to tease mm-hmm. them. You know, like in the old days, I know there's still bullying and things that go on, but these
yeah.
kids, they're starting to really wake up, and they're starting young. And it's in a multitude of ways, I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're just
yeah.
so hopeful and can see it,
mm-hmm.
and they care about the environment.
Well, I think there's a huge shift happening and with the younger generations, and
mm-hmm.
that this is very important. You know, Michael really wrote this. Part of the reason why he wrote this book was for the younger generations.
Yes.
And we raised our two daughters. Some of it was homeschooling, and they got this holistic history
mm-hmm.
In there when they were homeschooled. And both of them weren't totally homeschooled. They kind of went in and out of school, public school, as best we could, you know.
Yeah.
But education is so important. And in the book also talks about a global education and what an organic education would be like. Michael, you know, we still have an unpublished manuscript, which is, that global history of the world, which was really designed as a high school, college
uh-huh,
type of
right.
curriculum. And everything has to change. Everything. And,
well, you know, this book could be a really good gift to a teen. I mean, quite honestly, I see
yes.
that. I mean, I think that my son could get into this book, really, and
mm-hmm.
it would give him new ideas for writing his essays and, you know, as he gets ready for college, because this book is that
probably
approachable.
Probably the most brilliant student in his class.
Yeah, no kidding. It has every major philosopher. I mean,
yeah.
it really invites us as adults, too. I have to tell you again, this is so synchronistic that this book would come into my hands, because I really was asking that question. You know, as we get older, we start to feel a little ignorant sometimes because we're distanced from things, and maybe there were things
yeah.
we never really got the chance to study and we wanted to, and maybe there's things we just don't, you know, we need to understand things in a new way, and this book
mm-hmm.
is a gift because it's all in one place. And then you begin
mm-hmm.
to find those things you want to explore. So it really is cool, this book. Now, one thing I want to notice, I noticed we have a caller on the line, and I just want to mention to the caller that if you do have a question, make sure you hit a 1 if you'd like to ask a question, and then I'll know if you're listening just on the teleconference or if you actually want to ask a question. And I guess I can put out to those listening that if you do have a question, you can call in at 310-807-5104. You'll only be able to come in during the end of the live broadcast here. But just putting that out there in case this caller has a question, or sometimes they just listen
uh-huh.
On the line. It is a teleconference, too. That's the nice thing about Blog Talk Radio. It's both. So anyway, back to, I think we're really bringing this full circle, this global regeneration, and I am going to put that site up as well on the page. And, you know, even some of the work that I know it's a particular area, but even with the bees, I mean, that's been in the news too. You know, we have to be conscious. I just read an article on the Huffington Post within the last few days about
mm-hmm.
you know, really highlighting what a threat to the food supply it is and how, you know, what's gone on with the bees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's part of what we have to be aware of and how we have to shift into new ways of doing things, or we really do have an impact of our environment. And the bees tell the tale, don't they?
They certainly do. And, you know, what happened just 2 weeks ago is that the European Union suspended all neonicotinoid pesticides. They have been fighting for years. They're way ahead of us. We, you know, we're not listening to the science that's come out that verifies that it's these neurotoxic pesticides that are
mm-hmm.
causing not just the death of honeybees, but it's the research now points to the impact on aquatic life, birds, and other species, and They also have new scientific tests from Japan, and there are these tests that are done on mice that is like the litmus test for whether or not a chemical will do the same in a human brain. And and so they have proven that, yes, indeed, it causes immune deficiency disorder, it causes neurological degeneration, infertility, and cancer. So, and there's now other pesticides, too, that are beyond the neonic that are doing kind of similar things. So, you know, the paradigm is, oh, we have to poison the earth in order to get good food, in order to have enough food. And that
right,
is
that's
completely false. Yeah, that's what we're taught. Oh, I have to say right now that another book that I think everyone should read, I mean, get this book and read Global Awakening, New Science and the 21st Century Enlightenment. Get that book. But get Maria Rodale's book, The Organic Manifesto, because she says something absolutely extraordinary about climate change and about how we can avoid catastrophic environmental collapse on the planet. She points out that the largest carbon sequester system is the soil. And that the question is, well, why isn't the soil sequestering carbon? Well, the answer is because all the chemicals that we put in to the soil kill all of the good bacteria and the good organisms in the soil that are responsible for sequestering most of the CO2, the extra CO2 in the atmosphere. So it comes down to the ground we live on, you know. It comes down to literally just cleaning up the soil and going organic. And if we do that, just that one thing, over the entire surface of the earth, we could stop global climate change dead in its tracks. Just that one thing.
That's amazing. I hadn't heard that, and I hadn't heard of that book. I'm glad that you mentioned it on the show.
Well, I mean, you know, when I first started reading this, and she made the statement, I said, "Oh, really?" And then as she explains it, it's absolutely stunning. I mean, it's just completely true. And so many times, the answer is just like right at our feet, you know, or it's just right here at hand, and that we just don't see it. So
well,
as
look
we
at some
awaken,
of the, yeah. Well, I was just
so
going to
say,
discoveries
awaken,
in
things.
History. Yeah, I mean, so many. Like, how did we discover electricity and different? You know, I mean, why do we think we're incapable of what was done in the past? You know, sometimes I think we think we can't be as innovative. It's like everything's shut down, and yet it's not. I mean, there is this concept of being suppressed at times, and I think that has something to do with it. But but we are capable of that innovation.
Yes.
Leaps of insight.
Yes, and it can be anyone. Anyone can have a leap of insight. There was the teenager, the high schooler that built a biofuel generator in her bathroom. And, you know, this is just brilliant what she figured out. She made it out of all the parts that, you know, were just in the hardware store and all this stuff. And, you know, and so there's a lot of hope here with people just being experimental and going out and saying, hey, you know, I'm going to try this. I'm going to see if this works.
Yeah, and that's really all it takes. And you know, isn't that amazing? And I do see kind of this resurgence of the science fairs with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But they're starting even younger. And and it's amazing. They're really showing us what's possible, that you don't have to have. I read once, I don't know where I read this, but that fields are becoming so complex that they're, you know, you have to understand such a body of knowledge before you can actually make progress. Well, isn't that very limiting? I mean, I don't know where I read that, but I know I did read that somewhere where it's becoming almost impossible to learn certain fields. Well, what about creating new fields? That's not really true.
Well, we are going to create these fields that are really a synthesis of all of, you know, more than one field. and we're going to synthesize that information instead of breaking it down into little tiny bits.
Yeah.
Michael has talks a lot about this, that we are lost, or we drowned in the sea of detail at this point.
Yeah,
there's so much information. But there's a chart in the book that explains how what this new perspective is, and that the movement is towards the meaning of history. And then if we stand on the ground, that we understand the answers to those three basic questions of who are we, and how did we get here, and where are we going. To get the answers to those three questions, if we move to the center, which is the meaning of history, and that means the meaning of our story, our personal
yes.
story, and the story of the world, there's a band that goes around it. The chart is like concentric circles. So in the center
uh-huh.
is the meaning of history, the core. And then around that is called the centropic history of consciousness. And what that is entropy, you know, is to combine the elements, and then it produces this burst of energy or creativity. So in that realm is where we're moving into that realm. And then what happens is that by that viewpoint, we can look out into the whole. We can see the whole. And all of these details suddenly are more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly all these sort of problems that don't seem to be solvable, or details that seem kind of, you know, and without much meaning, all of a sudden you see how important that detail is. But it's all in relationship. It's all in that cooperative learning mode, and in that interconnected thinking. You know, where you're not just thinking about where, you know, your own little house and your own little life, and you're becoming actually what's called, you know, Kant talked about homo phenomenon, which is
yeah.
is the person who is just caught up in their own world, and but the new emergence of the evolution of consciousness, the new man and woman and child and life, is in the creation of the realm of meaning. And so what that is that then we think in the newest sphere. We start to
yeah.
think with our global brain. And, and so then we're starting to...
Our expanded consciousness.
Yes, and it's already happening all over the world. People are waking up, and we are making connections with people all over the planet. And as we do that, there's going to become a flip point. There's going to become a critical mass of people who not only are awake, but actually are active.
Yeah.
And we also learn from history that the major paradigm shifts, the major revolutions, and were done basically by only 1%, that creative minority. For instance, the American Revolution. There was many people who were totally on board with it, and they were sympathetic, but it was only about 1% of active people that caused the American Revolution. And create
yeah,
our democracy.
That's
uh-huh.
You know, we don't think of that. Now, we're coming to the end of the live broadcast, so
mm-hmm.
I want to put out real quick that if you want to keep listening, because we're going to carry this into the podcast a little ways, just call 310-807-5104, and you can listen to this on the teleconference line. You can continue to listen live. For those of you leaving us, the website, again, globalawakening.net, and there's also globalregen.net, which I'm going to put on the page. And the book we're talking about here is Global Awakening, New Science and the 21st Century Awakening. And I just want to – and we'll continue this in the podcast, which you'll be able to access at this same link that you're on right now. It'll be available in just a little bit. So, okay, just wanted to put that out because I know that we're going to carry this over as we usually do. You know, as you were talking, Barbara, something that came up in the last show. I mean, these two shows, they form this wonderful, in fact, it's not just these two, but there has been a series of shows in the last couple of weeks on this program, and they're beginning to interrelate in amazing ways, exactly the way you're talking about. And something that came up in the last show was this whole concept of open source and you know, not clinging to our ideas and our competitiveness as much. I mean, you honor the contributors. And I've witnessed this in the computer science field. I know someone who, you know, contributed to a big open source solution that's used by a lot of people. And and the people are honored for their contributions, but it's not the same. It's this kind of collaboration that we're talking about that occurs. It's at a higher level. And I feel like it's indicative of what's going on here, is that, you know, we're really starting to work together more. And one of the things that came up was that this same principle is being applied now to new energy, you know, new energy solutions, not just in computer science. I mean, it's showing up all over the place where people are starting to collaborate to shift this planet. I mean, because it's needed, isn't it? I
yes,
mean, when
it
need
is.
Arrives, like we're in right now. And so I'm very hopeful. And, you know, the other thing, and then I'll let you reflect on this too, because you're just making me really think with what you're saying, is so often, and I hear it on the radio, you know, I turn on the radio and there are these pessimistic shows sometimes where history as viewed, you know, even these quotes that say you're condemned to repeat it. Well, okay, yes, you know, that's a very famous, if you don't know about it, you're condemned to, what about the other side of the coin? You know, what about the part that are we condemned to repeat the Enlightenment? Are we condemned to repeat the Renaissance? I mean, what about that part of looking at history? And that's what this book is all about. We're not condemned to anything. I mean, that's talking about being ignorant, but even so, you see what I'm getting at is that why do we look at history in such a pessimistic way? Because we often do, when actually it has all the keys, and that's what really got me excited as I, you know, and I have much more to explore in this book. You know, I really want to spend even more time with it, but it really got me excited again about certain eras and philosophers and what I need to learn. I mean, it's, and you can probably feel it just in my expressing it. I'm excited about certain things again. And so anyways, I'll let you reflect on that a little bit, just reaction to it.
The interesting thing that this book, you know, this book talks in depth about the crises that we're facing right now.
Yeah.
It doesn't pull any punches. It's very,
it can be bleak.
You know, it throws us right up against the realities that we're facing. And yes, it's pretty terrifying. It's pretty discouraging. But the thing with Michael is that as he journeyed and explored this new body of information, which is really the, you know, taking, standing upon all the wisdom and the knowledge and creativity of the past, there's this feeling that humanity has at its core a loving heart.
Yeah.
And we have at our core the ability to transcend. And when we are empowered with this information that is here, then we can have the courage to go ahead and take the risk and commit ourselves to embarking on a new journey and determining what will happen in the future. In other words, we're not condemned to repeating the mistakes of history.
Exactly.
With awareness, it means that we're able to create history. With awareness, we get a new perspective and a new historical perspective and a new psychological mindset, emotional mindset, spiritual mindset, where we realize we can do something about this. It's not too late.
Yes.
And we do have the power. We do have the power. The people have the power to do this.
It's so true. And, you know, something else that comes to mind, Barbara, is just this consciousness. You know, why doesn't it include the voices of the past? You know, we have incredible, and your book, again, I mean, it really goes into what have the voices of the past taught us. And you know, not just the incidents, but the voices. And you know, these people are with us. They are present within the consciousness of humanity. Mm-hmm. And we can take those voices and bring them forward and do new things with what they inspire us to do. And that's mm-hmm. why it's so important. That's why when I look at this book, I think the young people need this. And mm-hmm. I really hope that, you know, whatever project, because I did read that at the beginning, that there was, you know, this project that you talked about. I can only hope that growing out of this will be, you know, a new way of looking at educating our young people. You know, really, you know, I think that when you talk about getting active, you know, who's creating the history books? You know, they say that most mm-hmm. of them come from Texas. I've heard in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And not
it's
necessarily
Texas,
written well.
Yeah. It's the Texas, what is it called, the textbook board? It's
yeah.
And it's so and it's a... They're all neocons. They're all
exactly.
You know,
it's very limiting.
Not just conservative. They are extreme right wing.
Uh-huh.
And what they're doing right now, you're talking to a librarian, so
yes,
I'm passionate about this, is that they're rewriting the history books. And one example is they in one grade school, like eighth grade or sixth grade history book, they removed Martin Luther King. And they substituted the story of the development of the National Rifle Association.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah. So they are rewriting
my.
History. And so it's more important than ever for people
yeah.
to know
yeah.
the real history.
Yes. Yeah, I believe
it.
And
for
it.
Us to make sure, as an older generation, we have to make sure that this gets passed on.
Yeah,
and
we need to teach our children to be questioners.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
I'm really fortunate in that I'm very engaged, you know, in having conversations with my son about different things he's learning. And you know, as a parent, I mean, I am just so excited about
mm-hmm.
what more we can do with this. And you know, without steering him, I love just letting him think. But, you know, we want to encourage our kids, and even from a younger age, and I hope that I did this as a parent, I certainly tried,
mm-hmm.
is to really question, you know, to have these
mm-hmm.
active thinkers, not just take whatever they're told. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe they'll begin to see some of these discrepancies, too, and say, hey,
mm-hmm.
you know, this, they might even question it in class and say, you know,
yeah.
this book, what about
yeah.
this, you know, something doesn't add up. And,
right.
And, you know, I don't know, you know, homeschooling, I mean, that's another approach. I mean, there's, you know, you always hear of homeschooling as a conservative thing, but
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be.
No,
but,
it doesn't.
But one can, yeah, one can hope there could be a movement, you know, I mean, some of that, too. There could be a grassroots movement
mm-hmm.
to teach, but I would hope to be able to bring it into the mainstream, you know,
yeah.
that's really...
Right.
You know, we can't allow history to be hijacked. I mean, that can't happen. There has to be a balance of voices.
Yeah.
And so, okay, yeah, you're really, really getting me thinking with all of
yeah.
this, Barbara.
Right.
And I know we could probably do multiple shows because it's just
sure.
such a depth here.
Uh-huh.
But I guess we should probably bring it kind of full circle, and
mm-hmm.
You know, I'll give you the opportunity to, you know, leave us with how do you want to bring this, you know, what's the final message, at least for this show, that you want to leave with everybody going forward, and also tell us about anything else going on around this work that we should know about. I know there may not be conferences or anything like that, but anyway, anything you want to communicate about the work and what's going on right now and just what you want to leave us with as we begin to close out the show today.
Well, I think what I would sum this up is one of the first things that Michael said when he was recovering his speech was, the answer is questions. which was a very profound thing for him to be able to regain and able to say. But we have to ask the right questions, and we can't just go into a cynicism that questions everything without just a knee-jerk reaction.
Right.
And you know, cynicism doesn't get us anywhere. And in fact, the new research coming out on the brain is that that cynics and violent people actually damage their brain with those thoughts.
Wow.
It actually destroys parts of your brain. So, you know, listening to, you know, these very violent, you know, doing violent video games and,
mm-hmm.
you know, going to violent movies, and it's a steady, the steady diet of fear and violence and all of this stuff. It's literally changing our brains. So I'd leave that thought with you. And what we can replace with that is getting a life that's rich with meaning and rich
yeah.
with exploration, and and be able to delve into the incredible creative geniuses of the past and what they've had to really say to us. I would say that. I would also say to not give up hope.
Yeah.
And I would also say is don't get distracted. There's a lot of things that are distracting out there. There's a lot of people who are being taken over by conspiracy theories and things.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be very careful, because that negativity and that fear-producing thing is not healthy, and it's not going to bring us to an awakening. And the reason why is that it's too convenient to have a conspiracy, right? It's too convenient to pin everything on one person. Oh, it's all Obama's fault, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very convenient, right?
Mm-hmm.
It means that we don't have to do anything about it. That we think that there's nothing that we can do about it because there's these aliens that are taking over the planet. You know, there's some really wacky ideas
I'm
out there.
I'm open to all kinds of things, honestly, but
yeah.
I think it would be empowering. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, but, you know, no, it's so true. We limit ourselves because usually there's a real hopelessness in these conspiracy
yeah.
theories. I mean, there
yeah.
is dysfunction in the world. I mean, the book
yeah,
talks about
definitely.
It. I
yeah.
mean, it's there's a lot of dysfunction, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's just that do we spend all our time focusing on that, and
yes.
then you get really hopeless. And I've seen
yep.
it. I see it all the time. You know,
I do too.
And Oregon's an interesting place. It's a dichotomy. You have a very strong conservative culture, and you have a very strong liberal culture living side
mm-hmm.
by side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of interesting to live here,
mm-hmm.
and you know. I came from I didn't mention this, I came from a very conservative background, and I can
mm-hmm.
still, I have an understanding of where people are coming from.
Yeah.
But, you know, deep in their philosophy too, Barbara, you know, they have this concept of heaven on earth and,
mm-hmm.
you know, incredible hope. And
mm-hmm.
it's built in to the same
yes.
minds that are,
exactly.
are obsessed with certain
yeah.
things. And
yeah.
And, you know, that I see hopeful. I mean, I
yes.
see that as hopeful.
And, you know, I have to say that when I use the term conservative or whatever, I have to qualify that because
yeah.
really if we're thinking in this new way of thinking, liberal and conservative doesn't mean anything.
That's right. That's true, too. Mm-hmm.
And all of the labels and everything don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I, too, came from a conservative background.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I understand the values that are in it.
Yes.
But just like everything else, you know, there's ways of things being corrupted. And,
yes.
You know, on both sides, on both ends. And so I don't think... in terms of, you know, strictly left-right or, you know, conservative liberal or any of those things. In fact, I really think that we need to sort of get rid of that.
Yeah.
And really,
and, you know,
and really embrace each other together. We are here on Earth together, and we can love each other.
Mm-hmm. And,
you know?
And, you know, as much as there are these divisions that I've seen, The other thing I see are these unusual partnerships. And, you know, really, it's true. You look down. I've had to explain to multiple people what does it mean to be a so-called new ager, because that's what I'm labeled.
Yeah.
And I say, well, you believe in heaven on earth, don't you? I said, that's the new age. I mean, there you go. I mean, so all of a sudden, we're all new agers if we have this hopeful view that we can enter this enlightened age. And, you know, it's a lot of times it's our terms, you know, in partnership with God. You know, God will be among us. And and what does that mean, you know, when you talk about God being omnipresent? You know, there's so many things that we actually do share, and even concern about some of the dysfunction. I mean, you'll see that too. And it can spiral into everyone focusing on the same conspiracy theory. That can happen too. There's unity in some of that. But also in its higher way, it can say, yes, you know, that's very dysfunctional right there, and but yet we believe in something more hopeful, and you really can find it. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm coming away from this conversation with a lot of hope, and honestly, it's been a really stimulating conversation. I really appreciate some of the things that you've brought here, and you know, just what Michael's book is introducing into all of this. I mean, it really is very profound, and I think it's gonna fuel the hope is what it's gonna do. And by fueling the hope, we actually make it happen, because we become, you know, much more positive. We begin to envision a positive future, and and so it creates it. And so let me say that I'm really appreciative of not only of you coming on this show, Barbara, but, you know, deeply appreciative of the work that, you know, such a lifetime of work that Michael did and what you put into it as well. I mean, what a gift. It's a gift to humanity, and thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And, well, thank you for being here.
And I'm so happy that I'm able to connect with people now. And, you know, this is giving me a whole new set of skills and experiences and a whole new set of friends. And so love the process, everybody. And, you know, and look into what we're offering here, you know, in the future.
Yeah, and I hope everyone does. And I encourage you to talk to more people. Get this message out, because, you know, shows like this, Barbara, we're just grassroots. That's what it is. I mean, anybody can start a show like this. And my hope is more and more people will. I mean, I just started one day on a whim. I mean, that was over 2 years ago. But there are so many ways that we can get voices out, and it's not hard. You know, you just start. It starts with you. And I encourage you to find other places to share this message, because I think you'll find they're out there. And, you know, you can really reach, you know, just anyone out there. I mean, it's just very accessible. So thank you so much.
Well, the time is now.
Yes, now. I agree. So, well, I do look forward to you know, continuing to explore this work and really just hearing more about it. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how all of this continues to evolve. All the things that you and Michael are involved in, including Michael's recovery. I think we're all hopeful for that too, now that you know, we're coming to know him through his work. So,
well,
and
you
through
can
you.
Follow that story. You know, you can follow that story at strokefamily.org at my website. And you know, I really hope that you'll stay in touch with us. And anyone really who's listening in on this program who knows of other people that we should contact or who would be interested in this, please feel free to contact us through our websites.
Yeah, and I encourage that too. And I actually may email this show to a few people that I think should know about it if they don't, because there are people that I think would really benefit. There's some synergy here. And so hopefully, you know, your being here today will lead to some really good things. And, you know, I'm sure there are other places, too. I mean, I hope synchronistically other places appear where you can share this message, because it's a powerful one. So thank you again, and yes, I will stay in touch, and I'll keep track of what you guys are doing. So so thank you just so much again. That's all I can say. I'm very appreciative of you being here today.
Well, thank you for being such an amazing interviewer. You're really excellent, and thank you for having us, you know, on your show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that affirmation very much. Thank you so much. All right. Well, you take care, and I guess you're heading into evening, so have a good evening, and, you know, give my good wishes to Michael, too.
I certainly will.
He's in our thoughts. He's in mine. So thank you so much. All right, just a few show notes as we wrap up today's show. I've got another show scheduled. We're getting more and more shows on the schedule. This show's I'm just reworking my schedule. You know, I'm just going with it. And so we're having a lot more shows now. The next show is going to be Saturday night. So we're going to have another Saturday night special, which I know is very popular. And I will be taking callers that night. And on Saturday, we're going to have Heather Green on the show. She was here very briefly at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles when I did the show from there. And she's going to come on for a full show. She's an energy healer and animal communicator, and she can talk to us about our animals. And just a real compassionate feeling soul that has a lot to share with us. So she's going to be with us for a Saturday night special, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, May 11th. And then next week, I have another quite full schedule, and I'll just give you the one that's next Tuesday. Alfonso de Rose, who is quite a popular spiritual leader, is coming on the show, and he's going to talk about love and relationships. And he's going to be here Tuesday, May 14th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. And then following that, I've got more researchers coming up. And it's not just yet, but I've signed up PMH Atwater wants to come on three months in a row. I mean, it's just, I am just so appreciative. Let me just say this. I am so appreciative of the community around this show, and I'm appreciative of your support, and I really feel that we co-create all of this together. And there's some really cool things going on, because the more researchers that come on here, it just creates this fascinating synergy, and who knows what we can create. And, you know, it's just grassroots, and this is just one example. So let me encourage people out there, think about what you can do. Just as an individual, what can you do? Maybe you can start a show. It's not hard. It doesn't take much. But really think about what you're led to do. So I want to leave you with that. And then also, if you want to learn more about this show, the archives, the upcoming shows, always just go to frontierbeyondfear.com. And there are also ways to support the show there, too, as well, if you're led to do that. So thank you so much, everyone, for being here. And once again, a special thank you to Barbara and Michael, because I'm truly inspired. I can always tell. I come off these shows like this on a kind of high, because it's just so exciting to talk to people who are making such a difference in the world. So, again, wherever you are, I hope you have a wonderful afternoon, evening, whether you're listening to the podcast in the future. And most of all, I hope you have hope, because we really can take this world to a very good place and create the reality we really want to see. So, thank you again, everybody.